Hey everybody, welcome to the next chapter of As the Story Goes. My name is Trav, and with me as always is my cousin and my cohort, Steven Saro. Steven, say hi to everybody.
Hello, did you just say As the Story Goes?
I hope not, because I bought the .com for Grows, and that would be embarrassing. It's not a podcast unless I botch the intro.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man being realistic.
As the story grows.
Hey everybody, welcome to the next chapter of As the Story Grows. My name is Trav, and with me, as always, is my cousin and my cohort, Steven. Steven, say hi to everybody.
Hi, everybody.
Aw, that was wonderful. He's here. How's your baby Alice doing?
She's doing great.
Awesome.
She's still got Cradle Cat. You ever have Cradle Cat with your kids, man?
No, everybody has skin problems, stuff like that, but nothing is as bad as Cradle Cat.
Yeah, she keeps scratching those little wounds back open, and it's been a few months of this, but,
ooh.
You know, we tranquilize her and everything's okay. No,
no,
she's doing great, except for Cradle Cat, and anyone who's got a child with Cradle Cat knows how stressful it is, and I applaud you for surviving that.
That's a bummer. I don't remember any Cradle Cap, nothing like that, but I hear what you're going through, and that's a bummer. Poor little thing doesn't know she keeps scratching herself open.
Yeah, it's like a habitual thing now. Like, even when we lube it up with, like, you know, the medicine and stuff, she's still, her arms don't know what else to do now, but go up and start rubbing everything. And
yeah, the habit is formed.
Exactly.
Man.
But yeah, she's a lot of fun, though. What else has been going on with you?
Nothing. Work, work, work. Typical boring stuff.
Yeah,
it'd be a boring podcast if I had to talk about what I've been up to lately. I just work all the time. I'm an exterminator, and it's spring, so it's basically ants all the time. And I'm dealing with that mostly more than that than anything.
Do you ever get ants in your pants?
I get ants on my pants. I don't let them in my pants, though. I have ways around that. And then I do a dance when I get ants on my pants. Yeah.
Wah, wah.
Such an awful... All our intros suck, anyway.
No way, that was a great one.
Speaking of medical conditions, you told me that you got the bends.
I have the bends.
Yeah.
The bends what is that, when you lose... Something to do like guys who go down too deep in the ocean.
It's something to do with decompression or compression when you come up too fast.
You come up too fast, or if you're surrounded by you have to have a certain level of oxygen or something in the room, or no certain, like, it has to be really low, or I don't know.
I'm not exactly sure.
Make you explode.
It's like, always an issue in submarine movies. I know that. Yeah,
because I don't know how it all works, but apparently if someone has the bends and they come up too fast, or they're exposed to too much of the oxygen, or however it works, it actually like bursts in your blood vessels or something, or you die because you internally bleed, or you literally just like burst.
I was talking about the Radiohead reissue. I don't.
It's not a reissue, man. It's not a reissue.
Oh, it's, whatever.
No, what you're referring to. Okay, let's get off the subject of the actual bends.
Okay, that's fine with me. All we're doing is adding to the awful intro.
I'm digging my hole deeper. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about the bends from Disco Volante, Mr. Bungle. We're talking about Radiohead, the bends.
Yeah.
They're magnificent. Back when they were an amazing band. Yeah, I said it. They did this awesome album called The Bends in 1995. We are celebrating, me in my heart, the 20th anniversary. This is the 20th anniversary of The Bends. That album,
20 years.
It still feels like it's not quite 20 years old. It's 20 years old.
No, which means
OK Computer is 18 years old, which is coming up to 20 years old.
Yeah.
So, okay, I don't talk about Radiohead much. I'm kind of done with them. I'm sorry. I just think they're just super boring now, and they like to hit a lot of loop pedals and stuff and dance around. It's a British thing I don't understand, but I will say, and I am a Pablo.
Limey bastards.
Yeah. I am a Pablo Honey apologist. I think that record's great. It's not the best, but
it was okay. Pablo was all right. Yeah.
It's got a lot of really good catchy songs. I love the vocals. I love the guitar work. The Bends is a magnificent album.
Bends, in my opinion, is one of the few timeless rock albums that came out in that era. Like, no gimmicks, just straight up.
It's
punch you in the mouth, rock and roll, and it's going to be good in 20 more years.
And to those who are our age and who have been a fan of music for as long as we've been fans of music, you get to a point in your age where you're talking about records that are 20 years old, and it's like you had a decade of a lot of music that you loved, and then another decade of a lot of music that you loved. And then it's like you have to sometimes remind yourself, let alone other people, let's go back to two of those decades ago when I was listening to all these awesome 90s records.
Yeah.
And Radiohead was one of those bands for me, you know, and there's a million of those bands, but Radiohead was an amazing band. And for at least four or so records, they were doing amazing things. And the Bends is, people forget that they were guitar, bass, and drums. And that's pretty much what they were on that record.
So
and freaking amazing stuff. So those of you who remember the Bends, go put that record on the turntable again, give it a spin. It's 20 years old. And,
I'm helping my buddy move tomorrow, and I'm going to, I'm actually going to load the Bends into my phone, and we're going to listen to it all day. That's going to be our moving
such
album.
Such a great record. Yeah.
I just decided it. He doesn't have anything to say about it. So,
there you go. That's a good moving record.
Now's the part where you ask me what I've been listening to.
What have you been listening to?
Ah, I'm so glad you asked. Jesse from Veritas turned me on to a band called Boom Said Thunder. And it's like "boom" in quotes, said thunder, almost like you would read it in a book. Kind of funny, kind of interesting the way it is.
Interesting.
Just great band. I can't stop listening to them. There's nothing over the top special about them.
Is it pop punk?
No.
Is it stoner rock?
It's got like a fuzz rock. They're from Brooklyn. They got a fuzz rock thing going, which I dig. Female fronted vocalist. I'm almost biting my tongue to say this, but it kind of reminds me of Bjork was singing in a fuzz rock band.
Like if Bjork sang for like The Sword or something.
Nah, Sword's a little bit too grungy, but she's not over the top quirky like Bjork is, but she got a little bit of quirk in her voice, and I just dig
that's
it.
Kinda
I just,
cool.
Yeah, I totally dig
it. I'm not normally a fan of female fronted rock bands, but there are a few pretty good ones out there, I have to say.
I thoroughly enjoy listening to a female vocalist, because it's such a sausage party in my music collection as it is with all the metal. I enjoy hearing a woman's voice once in a while, you know. But I really dig her voice, and this one song in particular called Four Letter Word, I love it. I can't stop listening to it. I haven't purchased this yet, because I promise, Boom Said Thunder, I'm flat broke because I went to Florida and I spent too much money on rum. But
rum and oysters.
Once you got oysters and fish sandwiches and gas, check them out. I'll put a link to them in the show notes, just to go listen to them, stream them on Bandcamp. But
cool man,
good stuff. The intro music. Let's talk a little bit about that. We got to bring it down and get sad for a second.
We were playing a track from Deliverance, Weapons of Our Warfare.
Yeah, because they shred.
Because that record is one of the greatest thrash metal albums, but unfortunately, and we're really late to the game with reporting this, but
yes, we are.
We kind of like reminded ourselves, you know, that happened, and we need to address this as fans.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Especially as a drummer, Chris Hyde's no longer with us at the very, very, very unfortunate age of 50 years old. The drummer, from that Deliverance album and Vengeance Rising's Destruction Comes, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, he played on Destruction Comes. He played on the very first Deliverance album.
He's been on a couple quintessential Christian metal albums, and he just passed away, 50 years old. Again, the internet with the whole he was fighting an illness thing. I don't know what he passed away from. I'm not sure anybody does. It's not really disclosed. But bummer, man. Just one of those drummers that was just heard and not seen. Does that make sense? He's just in there, just in the mix, doing it right.
He's not like on the forefront of everyone's minds when they listen to Weapons of Our Warfare. But
right,
if you ask the band, and I only know I say that because I've heard they reissued it on Weapons of Our Warfare on vinyl.
Yes.
So there's been a lot of like recent promotion of it again, and you hear a lot of stories about the band and Chris Hyde and what he, you know, how he contributed to it.
Yeah,
I would say that's his seminal record. That's Weapons of Our Warfare is a thrash metal classic. It's across the board, whether you're a Christian or not. It's a record you can listen to and be like, you know what, this is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And Chris Hyde, you know, he was a solid metal drummer. I'm sure he's done a lot of stuff more recently, but I mean, we're not in the business of obituaries business here. We're not like digging for who died so we can talk about it.
There's just been a lot of legitimate deaths lately.
Yeah, you know, like we want to acknowledge the people who've passed on that we're fans of, because
yeah, that's all.
Because that's part of why we do what we do is we're telling the story of people, whether they made it in the business, whether they didn't make it in the business, whether they're just doing this DIY, and when they're not, and when we lose them, when they pass on, we want to acknowledge, like, hey, we're fans of music and we love this music, and this is somebody that hopefully you've heard about and you've heard his work, and if not, we're gonna play it for you here because that's what this is about.
Yeah, if you never heard him before, you just heard him a little bit, and
yeah,
you know, he's legit.
To the family and friends of Chris Hyde, we say God bless, and you're in our thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, definitely.
And, so who are we talking to today?
I consider Warlord and Mr. Bishop's Fist to be kind of one of those legacy bands that people, like, most people maybe never heard them or weren't really into them or missed them.
Depends on who you talk to, for sure.
But if you talk to the right people, they were like, oh yeah, those were like important people. You know, we got a blessed opportunity to talk to Timothy Henderson, the drummer.
Yep,
and
the thing is, man, what's so exciting about this conversation is we're fans of Warlord, Mr. Bishop's Fist.
Yep.
There's a lot of fans of them in that circle, but Warlord was like the only band we ever had in if you were growing up and looking for Christians who played great music. They were the only band that gave us that kind of a thing.
And Doom.
Yeah, like the doom, like
they kind of
like
fell in. Yeah,
they were an influence on me and what we've done. They're still an influence on what we do and on teachers.
Totally, I think the type of music that Warlord was playing in 1997 is more popular now than it was in 1997. Because there's a lot of bands coming up now that I kind of feel like, yeah, they got some Warlord in them. they got a little bit of that doom, slow, Sabbathy, sludgy. You know,
They were, you know, they predated High on Fire, you know, they predated Mastodon and all that kind of stuff. And,
hey, now don't you go talking smack about my Mastodons.
I'm not talking smack about, look, I don't like them, but I'm not talking smack about them. But listen,
I'll crawl through this laptop.
Warlord has come, they did their thing. They came in, they made a big noise, and then they left. And it was brief,
but yeah,
that little window of time. They were a huge influence on a lot of
I think people. That's kind of what I dig about them is the fact that Warlord just pulled a pin on the grenade, threw it into the pit, went, and ran away. And that was, before anybody knew what was going on, they were gone.
A lot of the 20-something-year-olds kids now who are playing like sort of that fuzzed out, sludgy kind of metal, whatever, have a lot of love for Warlord. So this is a really cool opportunity to talk to Timothy and
we finally get to shine a light on the compilation that you've been working so hard on too. Yes. Because Tim's got some medical issues and we want to help. And Steven came up with a great he really kind of forged forward and he's pulling together a compilation. We're not gonna pay anybody's mortgage or anything, but we're gonna go down swinging and at least try, you know, and say that we did something.
Yeah, we had a really good conversation with Timothy and learned a lot about him, and I've been talking to him for years now. And the dude's like a musical bank, man. He knows he's got a lot of musical love in there, and we just barely scraped the surface with him. So,
before we get into it, one thing that we definitely want to say is thank you so much to Justin Carroll and Monastery Design for coming up with our artwork for the podcast. He did we have dumb ideas here, make them look cool, and he did. And
for those who don't understand the artwork, first of all, we're a few weeks removed, but we should have mentioned this long ago. But yeah, thank you, Justin. Justin's my brother-in-law. He played in Narcissus, for those who are fans of that band. He married
that makes him my cousin-in-law.
Yeah, and he's and we're gonna get him on the show one of these days. We got to get him on here, talk about
some music. I gotta talk to him too.
Yeah,
but, my family on here already.
we gotta get our moms on here.
My god, no. There's not enough bandwidth in the world.
My whole thing was I really wanted to, like, you know, with the whole, like, when we split with Black Vinyl Collective, I wanted to still have sort of a vinyl appreciation and sort of
definitely
a promotion, because that's my format of choice, and I'm a modest collector. So my whole thing with the artwork was like, let's try to do like an LP cover, like an old dusty something you'd find, you know, in Goodwill or something, and you have no idea what the music is, almost like a gospel record,
right?
Originally I wanted to have like a literal gospel record with just put our heads on it and just make it funny. But I don't know if it was your idea or Justin's to take that picture, but it just looks like a really cool, weird vintage album.
We were working together and I said, I want something that looks kind of from the era that we were born in. You know, we're 70s kids.
Yeah, totally,
I was born in 75. You were born in 78, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So I wanted something kind of classic rock, prog rock looking, and we used like Black Sabbath fonts and they looked rad, but they were like so obviously Black Sabbath. And then I told him maybe go down like a weird Rush path with some of the fonts and everything.
I would love to see the Sabbath one just for a possible t-shirt.
I'll send you a picture. It looks pretty cool. And
he
came up with this font, and it just smacked of, it just looked like a 70s album to me. And then he was like, what color? And I was like, I don't know, orange. Cause I love the Flyers. It's the only reason I picked up orange. And he was like,
you and your sports colors.
Yeah, I sneak them in, you know, I'm crafty like that. And, so we were horsing around with him, and he was like, how about this? How about that? How about this? And then he threw the one out there that he sent. And I was like, nailed it. Don't change anything. You're done. You're off the clock. How much do we owe you? Dude, he didn't even take anything. He's the man. So we're going to put a link in show notes for his design company, Monastery Design. Dude.
Yeah, and at the very least, let's promote him for that. And
yeah, he doesn't just make artwork for crappy podcasts that only have a couple hundred listeners. This dude has worked for like major companies before and done legitimate stuff. And if anybody needs anything like that, follow the link to what he does. He's made commercials that you've seen before. Let's put it that way.
Yes. So I'm not gonna sit here and list off his resume, but his resume is one of those resumes where, I mean,
no way. He's that guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, holy crap. You know, whether these companies, these studios used all of the work he's done is one thing, but he to say he worked on this and that, I mean, yeah, he's legit.
Thank you, Justin, for the artwork. We're going to keep it for a while, probably two or three episodes at least. No.
And, well, like any band needs a new record cover, an album cover. We're going to need a new album cover someday.
For reals. So let's get moving here on the conversation with Mr. Timothy.
All right.
Hey, Chris, you're throwing me off, man. Now play it fast. Pick up the tempo, Chris. What? Hey, I didn't say change it. I said pick it up. Now go to the dummy. Now play it fast, Chris. Look, man, I'm not paying $3.35 an hour for nothing. Faster! What a triplet, Chris. Look at me when I'm talking to you. Are you dead?
This week we're talking to Steven's buddy from the west side of the country, Timothy, not Tim, Timothy Henderson of the legendary band Warlord, amongst other noisy things.
Other legendary bands, yeah.
Mr. Timothy, say hello to everyone.
Hello to everyone.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's all the time we have, Tim. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It was real.
Go ahead, Steven. Some intros.
That lasted just about as long as the Warlord saga, huh? too short.
I did a lot of I did a lot of research on Warlord. Timothy, I remember Warlord hitting the scene. I remember hearing it. I do remember liking it. I do remember everybody else kind of having a little bit of like a. I'm not sure Rock the Faux Hammer got the critical acclaim that it deserved, but I will say that in 2015, it seems like everybody's listening to bands that sound like Rock the Faux Hammer.
That's probably true, yeah.
Am I overstepping my bounds by saying Warlord might have been a little bit before its time?
That's a good question.
I know. That's why I'm.
We were just kind of into what we were into, you know. I don't know if it was ahead or behind or what. It just sort of was what it was.
Yeah.
The bands to us that we were into were current to us. So, you know, as far as current trends and all that, I don't know. I mean, it seems like everything does come around, but it didn't seem like we were trying to do anything that nobody had ever heard before. Just we were doing stuff that. You know, things that we were already influenced by. So,
I think a lot of the fans, at least from my perspective, only finding out about you from buying it because it was on Tooth and Nail Records, or Solid State Records, whatever. I think that it was definitely like the stuff you were pulling from was definitely ahead of those kids. You know, the ones that were buying Warlord records, they probably had no idea. Like you were listening to some of those bands, like I don't think they even knew those bands. Like, and you know, in the Christian scene.
Yeah, I think anything in the Christian scene back then, was kind of like that. You had a lot of kids who only listened to Christian music.
Yeah, like to, you know, to you guys, you may have been like, well, we're just doing what we're listening to or whatever, but I think to the Christian kids, you certainly were like,
right,
over their heads or just ahead of the times or whatever, however you want to call it.
Yeah, I think we might have sounded possibly kind of like a new style or something to them, but it,
yeah,
definitely in the larger scheme, it wasn't anything new. It was just...
Yeah. I remember reading HM Magazine, they kept referring to you as like a heavier roadside monument.
Oh.
I think they were like close, but sort of a, like one band away from that, you know what I mean?
Well, that's interesting because of the catechumen thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that, I mean, that makes sense to me, but I think if they would have heard catechumen, they would have understood why there was a connection at all, you know?
Yeah.
Let's start at the beginning then. Let's like...
I was born a poor black child.
Really?
Sitting on my floor, listening to my LPs, my Mylon Lefevre LPs.
Where did it all start? Where did it all start for you, as far as like the first bands, the first live shows? Like, yeah, take us from the beginning and walk us through it.
Well, I was into music from way early. Like 5 years old is when I started really getting into music. So, you know, and that kind of had nothing to do with anything later. Well, actually, it sort of did, because one of the first records I ever heard was Paranoid. So,
right on.
You know.
That definitely.
And who did that?
Yeah.
My dad had the record.
No, I meant which band
was Black Sabbath?
It was a joke.
So, okay, sorry. Yeah. But, you know, back then, it's funny, I was just talking to my wife about this exact thing a few days ago. Music to me was like this kind of a revelation. Just I just went from being a little, you know, little kid with cartoons or whatever to just being exposed to music, and every once in a while I would hear a song that just hit, you know, just the emotional part of it just hit me. And it didn't matter, like, it was either, back then it was like, that was about 1975, so, you know, like 70s love songs and things like that, and then, you know, like Black Sabbath at the same time, was all the same to me. It was like you'd have just something that hit me emotionally, and that to me, that was like what good music was, and that was just sort of always the pattern stuck, you know. I never was really into a style. I was into like the emotion of what hit me, and it wasn't cool to like a lot of the things I liked, but, you know, it didn't matter to me, because it was the emotional impact. That it was like a drug, you know. It's like, I gotta have that. I gotta have something that's gonna tickle that nerve, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it was really early for me, and those things, I mean, I still listen to those things, you know, today, just those things from back then, so.
Yeah, would you say...
The details change is all.
Would you say you're pretty much just like, it's not like you're not trying to do, like, of course, later with the bands, like, it wasn't like you set out to do, we're going to be, like, the Christian this band or the Christian that band. It was just more of, like, a
culmination
of just so much stuff you dug, and whatever you were digging at that moment. It's just like a natural response to that.
Partially, yeah. I mean, with Mr. Bishop's Fist, it kind of was partly conscious of, like, I mean, we heard, you know, the Helmet Meantime record, and we were like, oh my gosh, you know, like, nobody's doing this. And if I was going to choose to be in a band, I could have, you know, been in a pop band or a jazz band. It didn't, you know, I liked a lot of different kind of music, but at that specific moment, it was like, man, nobody's doing this, you know? And this is just fun and easy, and, you know, to play this stuff is just a blast, you know?
Oh, good choice.
You're at that age where you're like, you know what, the energy is matching what I'm into.
So there was something conscious about, you know, There's a niche here that's not being filled, you know, in that market. Yeah. But, you know.
Now, who were you in Bishop's Fist with?
Well, the main members were me and John Ford, or Jonathan, he goes by, Jonathan Ford.
Uh-huh.
And, we had heard the Helmet
Jonathan
record.
Jonathan Ford, never heard of him.
Yeah. We heard that record, and he was already in a band at that time, and he was wanting to quit. And he knew that I played drums, and we heard that record, and we were like, man, we could do this, you know? We could actually pull this off. And we're like, well, we need a guitar player, because John played bass, and I played drums, and he had a friend that he was in bands with before that played guitar, so he kind of called him up and said, you're in the band, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a guy named Mike Jameson for the first while. I can't even remember how long we were a band, a year or two.
Did you, when you were growing up listening to music, 70s, 80s, whatever, were you like an angry guy at all? Did you feel like, man, I got to play some angry music?
No, I wasn't really angry about much until the Mr. Bishop's Fist era. It was, I liked the emotion of the anger. Like, I sensed it in other music and it drew me to it. But I also was just as drawn to, you know, sappy love lyrics just as much. It's like the key thing was there emotion in it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, totally.
Connectivity.
But, yeah, so with Mr. Bishop's Fist, I was already getting kind of pissed off at the church and all that sort of thing by then. Oh, okay. And so it was just sort of a natural outlet for that.
Gotcha.
But Jonathan was way more angry about things than I was.
Okay.
He was the dark seed of Mr.
Yeah, he wrote the lyrics to that. You know that first song that was like, how can you be so fake, you know? And it's like this big tirade against the church. He wrote the lyrics to that, and then I wrote the other two lyrics to the other two songs on our tape, and those are all like poetic and introspective and completely different feel to them. So you can kind of tell that we had different things we were working through, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So lyrically, when I listened to the demo, I always assumed it was just about a person. I never really connected it to any sort of church stuff.
The first song? That
first song, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was just sort of his expressing. He went to a Christian high school, and I guess the whole, you know, everybody's like hypocrisy and all that stuff, and
I
hate you guys. And
yeah, I've been there and down that road before.
Right.
Born and raised, me too.
So, but my lyrics were like more like philosophical in one of them, and then the other one was almost like romantic. So it's just kind of hard to find consistency lyrically, I guess. But
us drummers always try too hard when we're allowed to write lyrics. We always try to really sound deep.
Well, I used to write a lot. I had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of things I had written, and I just inserted them into, you know, music that we already had. So I was like, hey, this will fit with this, I suppose. And
that's cool. It's cool that you're able to do that too. I know that this is going to lead to a question, but I don't mean to talk about me, but I know when I attempt to write lyrics, I tend to really follow it rhythmically, and it seems to be like da-da-da-da-da, rhyming word.
Yeah.
And I know that some of the best songs aren't like that. They have a lot more they have a lot more ebb and flow to them, and they aren't so staccato.
Sure. But
as a drummer, I just write like dun-dun-dun-dun, click, dun-dun-dun, and almost like I could drop it onto the quarter notes, and
it just comes
out too choppy, and then I'm like, here, make this, polish this and make it more poetic. You know what I'm trying to say, but
if you write the song first, and then you're trying to match lyrics to it, it's really hard to get away from that.
Yeah. So that was going to be my question. Is there any particular, like, was it like, okay, this is the song I'm going to, you know, Timothy gets to write lyrics to this one, I'm going to make it was it just kind of throw a potluck and whatever comes out and sounds the best? And
yeah, we just kind of trusted each other. We'd, you know, just would look through things that we had written and be like, oh, that's, you know, we were both really open. So it's like, oh, that's cool. Let's just make this one work, you know.
So it wasn't like his song, your song. It was just kind of...
Oh, not at all. No.
Kind of casserole. Really,
yeah, it was a simple band. Jonathan's a simple guy to write with.
Right on. Okay, cool.
Did you... What exactly happened with the band? Like I know you guys... Did you officially release the demo? Was there like an actual physical copy of that available?
Yeah, this is how we got to record in the first place. We had just jammed out three, four, five songs through practicing, and then we heard that REX, which was like the only heavy label back then, was looking for new bands to put on a release called Demolition 2, and they thought, well, we're in a band now, you know. So we saved up $60 each. We paid $180 and went to a cheap Mackie ADAT studio and just within a few hours, just cranked out those three songs and submitted them.
I love that. The spirit of the demo.
Yeah, definitely.
The spirit of the cassette demo, man.
Yeah. We just figured we'd be lost in the, you know, pile of, you know, you hear stories about labels just not even looking at your tape, and if they do, it's, you know, there's 10,000 other better bands, but he called, like, Tyler Bacon was their A&R guy, and man, he called us as soon as he got it, and he's like, oh my god, who are you guys? You know, we're like, are you kidding?
Really?
Us? Really? Why do you care about us? You know, and
man, I had that Demolition compilation, and when I heard You're Stolen, I remember just being like, I never, honest to God, dude, I've never heard anything that kind of aggressive. I think it was just the combination of just sort of that, what would be Helmet. I mean, I don't even think I was in the Helmet yet. So, like, I think you guys might have opened the doors for me to get into, maybe you guys in that first Blenderhead album kind of had that sort of stompy, fuzzy sort of aggression to it. But Mr. Bishop's Fist was just so abrasively heavy, and I remember just it just blowing my mind. I listen to it now, and I'm like, you know, this is you know, early 90s kind of a demo quality, but it still just has that sound to it, man.
Thank you.
I can totally understand the reaction back then, certainly.
Yeah, he just wasn't used to getting things like that at that label, so. He's like, who are you guys? What do you look like? How old are you? I mean, he's just like, you know, I just can't believe there's a band like this around.
That's so cool.
What do you look like? That's funny.
Yeah, I mean, he just wanted to know everything about us. We're like, man, we're just these guys that decided to start a band a few months ago, you know? Like, we're not really anything. We haven't even, played a show at that. No, we hadn't played a show at that point, I remember. So, yeah.
It was weird.
I'm kind of hoping you told him, like, we all have long hair, parted in the middle, we kind of feather it.
Oh, that reminds me. I was kind of a prick to him. I was like, he goes, what do you, he goes, do you guys have shaved heads or long hair? And I go, why does that matter? You know, because I was like, who cares about image, man? Like, I was being all, you know, it's about the music. And he's like, well, because if you all had long hair, you know, it just wouldn't, you know. And I was like, well, yeah, I see your point.
You guys were ahead of your time because you were.
Like, yeah, we had shaved heads. All right.
Tell me about it. I ran into that so much. I got so tired of hearing that where it was like, you know, that band's pretty good, but they're not wearing enough glitter eye makeup.
I'm it's like, so weird that that even was a thing back then, like, caring so much about what you looked. I always thought it was cool when bands looked a certain way, but then when they started playing, they were just freaking out and didn't look like the part that they played, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
You know, one guy with a t-shirt and jeans, another guy with like a... Like, that's kind of why I like Believer, I think, because they, you know, one guy was wearing a t-shirt and jeans, the other guy was wearing like a white dress shirt with a black vest.
Joey
had no idea what they're.
We used to get that all the time. Yeah, bass player is dressed like a skateboarder, and your guitarist looks like he's in a Nine Inch Nails, and your drummer's wearing a short sleeve dress shirt. What the hell are you guys thinking? And I was like, well, grew up listening to Believer. Like, Joey was allowed to wear a Youth of Today t-shirt, and Kurt had like a Dave Mustaine white collared shirt on. Nice. They were awesome. I don't care. You know, like, what
right.
doesn't matter. Oh, whatever, dude.
So,
yeah,
you guys were, this was REX, right? You said.
Yeah, that was REX. And
so they wanted to sign you.
Well, no, they wanted our song to be the lead off track on that. And they were interested in us. So, you know, they call that courting when the label courts you. And so they flew out to Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, the raging metropolis that we were from. And
really,
they flew out to you.
Well, that's how it works. When a label courts you, they come out and they usually set up, you know, they call it a showcase. They set up a thing where they can watch you play. And like in this case, he stayed with Jonathan while he was in town.
Right,
and
right.
Tim Cook was the local. Well, he's about an hour away at this club called the Warehouse, and he was the only thing even remotely, you know, close to going on for a scene in our area. And he was managing, you know, like Living Sacrifice and POD and
Scattered Few, I think, was managing.
Scattered Few, yeah. Oh, and wow. So he said, like, you need to connect with Tim Cook, or I think. It's hard to remember all the details, but I just remember we sent the tape to Tim Cook, and then Tim Cook did the same thing. Oh my God, you guys are from here? I can't believe this.
Unreal.
He's like, I want to manage you. So we met Tim Cook, and then he's like, I'll be your manager for free. I just am so excited that there's a band around here that's like this. And right so on. Then they set up the showcase, and then the A&R guy flew out and watched us. And
I'm still amazed someone flew to – you can pull that card out in any conversation with a band now and say,
yeah,
yeah, right? Yeah, you guys are great. Did anyone ever fly out to see you?
I think it's pretty common for back then. There wasn't as many bands being signed, you know.
I missed the fly out.
did they fly out? I have questions now. Did they fly out and come see you guys play a show, or did you perform for like four guys sitting there with?
Oh no, it was a they would that wouldn't be a showcase. I mean, it would. Because, I mean, part of the dynamic of playing in front of people is, you know, it's how does the crowd get it? They're not just wanting to see you. They're wanting to see how people react to you. They're wanting to see how you interact with the audience. You know, they're just kind of wanting to see, well, what's it like when you play? If they showed up in your garage and watched you practice, it wouldn't really show them what they want to see.
The reason I ask is because I know a couple people that are on the pop side of things, and they've actually done showcases for major labels, and it's like there's like 11 people sitting there with clipboards, and they play their hearts out, and they just pour blood onto the stage, and when they're done, they get like a, you know, tap, 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 and I'm like, okay, thanks, we'll call you, and they're like,
oh, yeah.
I have no idea if that went well or not.
So yeah, I think maybe that could possibly happen in a different scene, but I've never really... You know, the showcases I've heard of, they want to see you live. You know, they want to see, can you affect an audience, basically? Because, you know, they're just a big bank, you know. They just want to see if they can make money off you. Yeah. So if you get up there and you're awesome and the audience doesn't care, it's like, well, we love you, but nobody cares about you, so we're not going to invest in you.
Right, I get it. Okay, awesome. Cool. Interesting.
That guy, Mike Jameson, that was the guitarist, was kind of a... He didn't really fit in the band that well, and he was just being, just goofing around the whole show, just being silly, and I'm playing, hitting as hard as I can, and John's screaming his brains out, and he's up there dancing around being a weirdo, and, you know, and so, yeah, he wasn't too impressed, I think, with the show, but...
At what point did the Help Us Amongst Friends Tooth and Nail compilation, was that around the same time?
Yeah, that was after. We heard about that. I knew Brandon from back when I lived in Portland. And
oh, really? Okay.
And then he went to work for Frontline Records, and then he started Tooth and Nail. And then we heard about the Helpless thing, so we sent the same tape to him. And we were like, well, REX already has the one song they're putting out. So he picked another song, and he said, I want to sign you too, basically. And we're like, that's interesting, because... You know, Tyler Bacon has already flown out, and, you know, we don't know if we're getting an offer, and we don't know what's up. And so Brandon called Tim, and he's like, I want to sign this guy, you know, these guys. And Tim was like, you can't sign them. And the weird thing was, back then, secular distribution was a huge deal for a Christian label. Like, if you could get outside of the bookstores and into real, you know, like, record shops,
then
that was priceless. And so REX, because of Circle of Dust, had distro through Relativity Records, and they could put out four records a year, once every quarter, or three records a year, I guess that would be. And they didn't have enough cool bands to do it. So they let Tooth and Nail pay them money to have the right to put out a record that got to be distributed into a, you know, the real scene.
Wow.
Tim said, if you try to sign these guys, I'm going to yank your Relativity distro. And he was like, and when we heard about them, we're like, there's no way we're signing with REX now. You know, what a bunch of, you know, bleep, bleep, bleep. And I think that Tim... lost interest in us anyway, so I don't think that was like a big deciding factor. But then after that, then there was a thing called Tooth and Nail Weekend out at Tim Cook, our manager's place at the warehouse, and they put us on that bill so Brandon Ebel could have a showcase for us. And then after that show, he took us out and said, you know, yeah, we asked all the other bands, and they really want you to be on the label too, and we want to sign you. And so we were like, cool, well, Tim is our manager now, so you'll have to talk to him. And then Tim had, you know, huge hopes for us, so he kept negotiating. It was like a year he was negotiating with them, trying to get us like a real record contract that no bands ever really got back then, so it was kind of pointless to try. But it was like, you know, you would get a call every 2 weeks, like, well, we got an extra half point on the record for you, and like, oh, okay, when are we going to record? Well, we want to hold out until it's a perfect deal. And then 2 weeks later, well, we have 50% control of the artwork now. You know, like, okay, you know. And it kind of went on like that, on and on and on and on. And we were practicing and playing shows. And eventually,
you were letting all the record people play chess, right?
Yeah, basically. Eventually, we just kind of lost interest in Mr. Bishop's Fist. We were getting into It took like a year, and we were getting into, you know, like the Louisville scene had hit, and, you know, we were getting into just so many different kinds of bands that Mr. Bishop's Fist just wasn't Mr. Bishop's Fist anymore, you know? It was a whole different kind of thing. And so that's when we met Ricky and Nathan from Fuse of Ire, and then they said, why don't we just join up, you know, and make
that's
a band?
Hilarious.
And we're like, well, we already have an offer, so why don't you guys join Mr. Bishop's Fist? And we're like, no, we want to start something new. And we're like, you know what? Let's just practice together once and see what happens. And we did, and it was magic. It was so much better than Mr. Bishop's Fist. So that day we called Tim, and we were like, well, sorry, but we quit. We're making a new band. And he's like, what? I was your manager for a year trying to get you a deal. We're like, well, you know, sorry, but it's just we're already past this, you know?
Right.
That's hilarious.
So, yeah, we didn't. I think we burned a couple bridges there. But Brandon signed us anyway later, so I guess he wasn't too pissed off. As, you know, as Warlord, he signed us, so.
What would you attribute that to? Like, like Brandon obviously knows what he's doing when it comes to signing bands. Did he still see, like, okay, this is a newer... A new direction of what I still see that I loved with Mr. Bishop's Fist?
I think it was just a whole new thing to him. I mean, by the time he heard us as that, we had gone from Mr. Bishop's Fist to Catechumen to Warlord. Uh-huh. And he heard just a little boombox recording that just me and Ricky, just guitar and drums, had done. And evidently he thought we were like the Christian Unsane, I think is what we heard. And so he didn't have a band like that, and so he wanted us to record. So, but yeah, anyway, that's skipping a few years, but
yeah. I was gonna say, I want to play some of these bands of yours. So we're it sounds like we're venturing out of Mr. Bishop's territory.
Thankfully.
Although I have to say real quick, I was fortunate to catch a live concert of Mr. Bishop's Fist. I don't know too many people in my circle.
What?
Where did you see us? Oh, it had to have been at Cornerstone.
Yeah,
at
Cornerstone Festival 94. I was 16 years old, and I had the two songs from the two comps.
Yeah.
I was a big fan, and...
What year is this?
95.
This is 19...
No,
this is 94.
Yeah, 94.
But, yeah, I got to see the band, and it's crazy. It's amazing to hear that you guys were so close. Like, it was like if Tim Cook had just said, yes, okay, we're good, you guys would have been in the studio, and we would have had a full-length studio recording of those songs, which probably would have sounded a million times better.
No, it would have sucked, because Brandon wanted Jason Martin to produce it.
Really? That is so weird.
And Jason was talking to us about it. He's like, what I want to do is I want to make the kick all real tiny because everybody makes them all big and we want to fool everyone. And I don't want just, you know, traditional Marshall, you know, and Gibson. I want you to do real experimental. And we're like, dude, we're not Starflyer, man. You know, like, we just want to make a real, you know, record. And so it would have been a struggle. So
right, yeah.
I'm sure nobody went to Helmet and said, we want to make the kick real tiny.
Yeah, can you make this sound like My Bloody Valentine, maybe?
Right.
Why would I do that?
Yeah. That's yeah, we're not going for big, overpowering sound here. We want you guys to sound dainty and smaller.
Yeah, and experimental and weird.
Just rock. So,
yeah. So what song should we play from the demo?
Well, if you have a choice... The one that most people don't know is Container.
Okay.
And that's the one that's kind of all introspective and philosophical that I was talking about. And
sure. Well, why don't we do that? We'll play Container, and then we'll get back into some of your story.
Sounds awesome.
Like a plan.
I crawl in the emptiness.
It gives something to take. Here they left. Here I am. There's something bigger, better, leads me into a job.
So then, Fuse of Ire. So that was, of course, Ricky's band. They were doing. They were in like a similar situation, right? Like a precursor, hardcore, heavy sort of band that was
gonna
eventually do Warlord.
They were kind of. They were more. They were less commercial, I guess you'd say, than Mr. Bish's Fist was. Mr. Bish's Fist, I think people could adapt to it, whether you had heard that stuff or not.
Right.
And I think Ricky and they were more into like Rorschach, you know, Inside Out, stuff like that, and you know, some of that kind of thing, and a lot more noisy and
interesting.
Yeah. So it seemed pretty different, and Fuse of Ire thought we were very different from them too, you know. So.
Yeah. It sounds like almost like you guys were missing pieces to each other's band. You know,
well, and you know, a year or two had happened, and we had both heard a lot of similar music. So it was kind of like, you know, two bases of a pyramid and kind of going up and meeting in the middle. We had been listening to the same stuff, so we just sort of, we got noisier and they got more, a little more defined, I guess you could say. And
so tell us where that led. Tell us about that band, because I hate trying to pronounce it, Catechumen, right?
Yeah, well, that's a on-purpose mispronunciation. It's catechumen. It's a Catholic term. Oh, that sounds even cooler. Yeah, it's like oh, catechumen is somebody who's studying about God, basically. And our singer Nathan had found it in a dictionary, and just mispronounced it. He's like, catechumen. And we had all these other names. Like, we were called Lock Number 19. We were called Killed by Inches. I'm trying to remember. Yeah, so he saw it and thought it said catechumen, and so we were like, whoa, what does that mean? And he explained it. We're like, oh, that's cool. So our t-shirts were the phonetic, you know, with a K and, you know, upside down E and everything. And so it would say catechumen, and then people say, what does that say? We'd say catechumen. So when you see it phonetically, it doesn't look anything like catechumen. But right. So it was like another way to confuse people, another way to that's be hilarious. Sarcastic, I guess. But what did you ask about catechumen? How did that...
Well, I was going to say, for those who kind of are in the circle of people who know the bands you've been involved in, and, you know, if you get to talking to Ricky and, you know, people in the Warlord circle, everyone references this band as kind of the most exciting thing you guys have worked on, or the most pure, or the most, you know, of all the influences that came before and after, like it all sort of accumulated into that, into that band, and yet it's almost like a rumor. There's nothing to show for it, so that's kind of an interesting thing. It's like almost become like a thing. Like people who heard it maybe or saw it briefly like before it, yeah. And you know, to this day, I mean, like people hear about it, but they're like, supposedly this thing was magic. This was like,
yeah,
thing that they did. So
yeah, the few people that have seen it that band play, it's all been pretty like they're just in shock about it. And
yeah, that's it. it's like the legend lives on, and it's like so huge in everyone's mind because nobody really got to experience it.
Yeah, so we played two shows. One was in our own living room for about 15 people, and then we played the skate ramp at Cornerstone, and maybe 30 or 40 or 50 people saw that. So yeah, nobody pretty much has seen Catechumen, and we never released anything, so nobody's really ever heard Catechumen except for us.
That's so wild. So tell us that story. Tell us how on earth something that good did not get a full-length album.
Well, we actually had a record offer from that little label Flying Tart.
Oh, and yeah.
We were supposed to go record with you know, Steve Hindelong and Derry Daugherty.
And, oh my gosh, are you kidding me?
Dude, no, I'm serious.
Produced by the choir?
Yeah, that would have been pretty weird. There's actually a chance it would have turned out good because, you know, they have that aesthetic of kind of using the room as part of the sound of the recording. You know, they don't try to close mic everything and make it all kind of separate, because Catechumen was more like one big sound hitting you. You know,
yeah.
And I think they might have had a chance of pulling it off, but who knows?
Yeah, I don't know much about Derry's production stuff, but Hindelong did some. I mean, he worked with Fluffy and stuff like that. So I mean,
I didn't know
he
that.
Was kind of, yeah. He worked on that last that.
I
Sugar
thought Chris whatever did that.
Well, Chris Colbert was the
Colbert
songwriter, and he was in the band, but it was recorded, I believe, together with Hindelong, and Hindelong produced it. He's even performs on it and stuff, and that's a pretty avant-garde, weird sort of heavy band to be working with. I mean, so it wouldn't be too much of a stretch, although I have to say it'd be a really interesting thing to see you guys in a studio with dudes like that, because
yeah,
they're from a completely different cloth, you know what I mean?
This is blowing my mind. I thought the story went from Mr. Bishop's Fist to Warlord. I didn't even know this band existed.
Yeah, to be honest, Catechumen is the only band I'm actually proud of out of all those bands.
Wow. You've said that before, and that's another reason why I wanted to bring them up, because I guess I'm mourning the loss of this band, because you know, after everything I've heard and the very little bits that you've shown me of the practices and stuff, it really is like a almost like wish you guys would just like put a thing together now just to preserve it.
I really want to hear this now.
A quick question about the Dairy Daughter thing. Was that going to be in the Green Room studio?
No, they already had moved to Nashville by then.
Oh, okay. That's what I
thought. So it would have been in their, I forget what their name of their studio is, but it would have been in the 1994 or maybe early 95 version of their studio, Neverland Studio. That's what it was called.
Yep, that's it.
And I'm not sure what they had for equipment, what they, how well they understood engineering and all that, but.
Unreal. You know. That's just, I can't even believe you guys almost recorded with those guys. It's wild. So
there would have been a lot of ways to do that record wrong. And so, in a sense, I'm a little bit glad it never got recorded, but I don't know.
Can I ask a dumb question?
There are no dumb questions.
What happened? Why didn't, if that's the one thing that you were proud of and you had all this stuff lined up and everything, what happened?
Alex, the guy who ran Flying Tart, who used to work at REX when we were talking to... Alex was like the cool guy from REX. He was the guy who actually got it, And he went off and started Flying Tart, and they put out like Joe Christmas and Splendora and stuff like that. And,
and that Fluffy album I was talking about.
Oh, he did? Okay, right on. Yeah, that was on that record. So he called me up and was, we should definitely record you guys. And he goes, why don't you find a local studio and just do whatever you want in it for a few days and I'll pay for it. And I was like, okay. So I didn't know what to do. So I took the master tapes from, or the multi-track tapes, I should say, from Mr. Bishop's Fist. And I went to the studio and I did a dance remix of... Confuted System, and I just added a bunch of Star Wars samples to it and just changed it all around, basically. And
jeez, dude.
Well, I made the last half of it like a ballad. I added like this real emotional piano, but John was still screaming his brains out over it, and so I turned that into him, and he's like, whoa, this is really creative. This is going to be great to do Catechumen. But the studio kept calling me and saying, Alex has never paid the bill. You owe me for 2 days of recording. And I was like, well, dude, it's not me. It's, that was the label. And so the more I found out about Alex, the more I found out he did this a lot, where he put people in studios and never paid the bills.
Oh. And, I've heard some strange things, too.
Okay, so that actually, now that I have had time to think about it, that's what happened, is that we sort of lost some respect for him and didn't really want to work with him.
Okay. So that makes a little bit more sense.
So that makes sense why you didn't work with him. However,
well, no, but you have to figure nobody knew about us. We had maybe, I would guess we had about 300 practices. We practiced constantly 6-7 days a week for four hours at a time. And we were, that's one reason why we got good, is because we practiced so much. And but we never played in front of anybody, so nobody knew about us to offer us anything,
Right. What was the what were the influences that were pouring in at that point?
Oh gosh, that's a trick question.
Not the choir, right? The choir wasn't one of
them. Well, I liked the choir, but no, that wasn't affecting. There was just so many great bands at that time. That was just a renaissance for my life in music right then. We were just hearing about so many great things. Catechumen was kind of strange because it wasn't like Warlord was just a heavy band, but Catechumen wasn't. We had heavy stuff, but we also had really pretty stuff and kind of everything in between. It was like anything that kind of put a picture in your mind, it was like almost like storytelling music to me. Like you could hear it and then your mind would just sort of flood with these movies and images and picturesque, I guess you call it. I don't know.
Right.
But so it's just a weird conglomerate. Like, I've never heard a band like Catechumen, but there are a million influences in Catechumen, so there's like little elements here and there. Like Mr. Bishop's Fist was pretty straightforward. We were into maybe, Fugazi, Jawbox, Helmet.
Yes.
Quicksand, was pretty. There's like name 5 or 10 bands, and you had us pegged. But yeah, Catechumen wasn't like that. Catechumen was like conglomeration of like 100 bands, you know, and each one of them just contributed a little bit to the flavor.
Mm. I'm dying to hear this.
Well, I edited a few things together, just some clips of one pretty like sloppy song. But yeah, I'll let you go ahead and play that. So it's kind of like it's with some hesitation, I guess, just partly because I don't know if the other members are cool with me doing that, but also just because it's really sloppy and it's just a boombox stuck out, you know, recording as jam. So it's not exactly a flattering representation of us, but, you know, it is what it is, and if somebody likes it, then great.
Coming back out of this, is this basically like, okay, so that band never played and then we formed Warlord? Like, is that the direction it's going?
Well, the plan was for us to all... I'm from Portland, and Jonathan had visited Portland with me. We both flew out there together, mm-hmm. and he loved it. And so the plan was... and Ricky and Nathan had visited there, too. So we thought, you know, we could either stay in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, population 8, you know, or we could... go to Portland. So the plan was play Cornerstone and then just go from Cornerstone to Portland and live there. And we played Cornerstone, and then Jonathan met the Roadside guys and the Blenderhead guys and just really connected with them. And then when it was time to leave, Nathan, our lead singer, his car broke down and he couldn't figure out what to do. So he's like, well, I'm just going to go back home and I'll figure something out, and then I'll just move out there, you know, in a few weeks or whatever. And so me and Ricky and Jonathan moved to Portland, and then within a few weeks, Jonathan just said, I've been invited to go stay up in Seattle with the, you know, the Blenderhead and Roadside guys. And, oh, what does this mean? You know, it's like, well, I don't know. And so he went and he moved up there, and, you know, the rest is history. He joined Roadside, and so that left me and Ricky as, like, well, are we really Ketechemen, you know, because it's just us two.
That's wild.
Well, when we got there, there was this fest called Tom Fest out there. And,
oh, yeah. Been there.
Okay, I didn't know that. Awesome.
Tantrum played there in 2000.
2000?
So, yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah, okay. So we got there in 95, and... I had known Mikey from, you know, when I lived there the first time. He was in Nobody Special, and he quit Nobody Special, moved to Portland, and kind of got involved with all the Portland bands there. And then I moved away.
He was the vocalist of Sometime Sunday, right? You're talking about...
Yeah, he was in a. He was like in the Gecko Monks before that, and then he did Sometimes Sunday, and so we moved out there, and he's like, "Hey, you want to play Tom Fest? Sure." And it was just me and Ricky. We're like, "What do? You know?" We're like, "Well, everybody calls us the Kentucky Men because they can't say Ketchumen, and we're not really Ketchumen without the other guys. So we'll just do a joke show as the Kentucky Men." We kind of didn't know what to do, so we did a Black Sabbath cover, I think. Yeah, we played Iron Man, actually. Well, yeah, we made it. Oh, go ahead.
I was gonna say I have the infamous Warlord VHS tape with that show on it.
Okay.
No way. I remember you were. I remember a fake beard worn by you, if I remember correctly.
Fake wig, actually, if I remember right.
Yeah, and you were. You were like standing up like an arena rock douchebag drummer, like you know, like hair metal guy.
Yep.
Like, doing like all the rock.
Oh, band. We played a Messiah Prophet band, Master of the Metal. That's right.
Wow, Cliffy from the Huntingtons. He just sent me a remastered Messiah Prophet album. That's so random that you just brought that name up.
Oh, weird. That is weird. Well, I forgot we did that song until you talked about the hair metal thing, and I was like, oh yeah, we did. We did so a cool. Black Sabbath song. But we did it our own way. We screwed it up a lot. Yeah, and then we did Messiah Prophet, and we did a Cherub song. We did three songs. And so that was the Kentucky Men. But then after that, we were like, it was just in us to play. So we just kept playing, practicing at his place. And everything changed when we saw Neurosis for the first time. That was just revolutionary to
what both happened of us. There? You guys just... Heard of them and didn't know what they were like and went and saw them? Or...
Yeah, Ricky was more into them than I was at the time. Then when we saw them, it was the tour Through Silver and Blood was just coming out, and they were supporting that record. Oh,
man. That's
and
that's
it just... Yeah, I mean, it's possibly... I'd say maybe it's tied, but maybe two or three other things in my life of like the most profound thing I've ever experienced. Wow. I mean, I'm talking about like the birth of my children, and you know, things like that.
Oh man, that's a concert. I'm jealous. I
yeah, it was crazy, and I've seen him like three or four more times after that, and it was never the same. So it was just that one right place, right time, everything. And so, of course, we were like, "Wow," you know, we were already had elements that were in that direction, you know, but
right.
That's what made us become a little bit more of a metal band rather than a whatever Ketchumen was.
Right. Just brought that sort of aggressive wall of sound. Sort of.
Yeah.
Neurosis.
Yeah, exactly.
And would you... I know you guys had some tie-ins with Today is a Day, and we'll talk a little bit about that with the Foehammer, but were they... Was that happening too at this time? Or was
yeah, they were an influence for Ketchumen completely. I just forgot.
Oh, that happened even before Warlord. Okay.
Yeah, well, Supernova came out before... Ketchumen was even a band, so that had already happened.
Oh, cool. So like the whole like AMREP era of Today's a Day, you were there from the beginning for all that?
Well, I think their first record was 93 and Ketchumen was like late 94, early 95.
Wow.
So we were a year late to that party.
Right in that zone, yeah. That's cool.
And then Willpower came out and you know that connected a lot. And you know, Carp, of course, I should mention them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's funny because they were from Portland area, but we were in Tulsa when we heard Mustaches Wild, and that was just yet one more thing that we were into. And
yeah, we were digging them too around that same time. Ironically,
nice.
I got into Carp and all that stuff at the same time I got into you guys.
Oh, okay,
so
cool.
It would have been sort of similar time.
Yeah. So, but yeah, Warlord just kind of more focused on the you know Unsane, Neurosis. Carp, and that first record, I didn't really hear any of Today's the Day influence on it myself, but we always loved the production of Willpower, so we just recorded our practices, and we sent one to Brandon, and he said, "What 90 Pound Wuss is recording with Tim Mack, who recorded the Supernova record of Today's the Day," and so we thought, oh, wow, that's like a dream come true, and it was a A-plus studio, so... He said, I'll just book another 2 days onto the time, and you go and you record a 7-inch, and we'll just see what happens. So we went up there, and we just got way overly ambitious and we recorded like 30 minutes of material, you know, in one day, and then he had a day to mix it.
Who was in the band by this point?
Well, just me and Ricky, and then we needed, well, no, we'd actually need a second guitarist. We just, our friend Brian Fletchner, who was in a band called Pickadown locally in Portland,
yeah.
And we just loved his stage presence so much. He was just really super fun to watch. And we had him come practice with us a few times, and he kind of struggled a little bit, and then he got the songs down, and he was just like a perfect addition to the band. So he was just had joined our band when we went up to record, but we didn't have a bass player, so we just called Jonathan and said, you know, we're recording a couple songs. They're not that difficult. What would you think about just... since we have a bass player filling in for this one session. He's like, sure.
And then, so he played on the EP.
He played bass on the EP and then did some background vocal and gang vocal. Hmm. And so, yeah. So we didn't have a permanent bass player. And then eventually there was a guy, Phil Smith, who was in a... Mm-hmm. I can't remember the band he was in, but he was in a band with our friend Chad. And he ended up auditioning and was a perfect fit. And that became more the permanent lineup.
John Ford on bass. I don't even think I knew that he was on that.
I didn't know that either.
That's pretty.
Yeah, I think that's why you hear a lot of people say, you know, Warlord was a side project of Jonathan Ford from Roadside, and I could see why people would think that, because he actually did play on the Warlord record, and I think people thought he was the guy that people know, and we were a bunch of nobodies, so. It must have been his side project or something, but it's kind of the other way around. It was our band, and then he just filled in on that one session.
Brandon tells you to go in the studio and make a 7-inch.
Yeah.
Next thing we know, we're getting a CD with 4 songs on it. What happened there?
Well, because we were too ambitious. We just thought, you know.
Like, from Brandon's point of view, though, was he like cool with that? Like.
Well, we had one day to record and one day to mix, and we just were stupid and decided to record instead of, you know, a 7-inch would have been about 8 minutes of material. We recorded 30 minutes of material.
Right.
And so that's why the recording sounds kind of weird, because there was just
track,
no time.
Track two wouldn't have even fit on a 7-inch by itself.
How long is track two?
9:41.
Yeah, that's funny. It would have been like an 8-track tape. It's like, please flip it over right now and go to part B of the same song.
Yeah, where the road, where the song forks. You get halfway
exactly.
Through, like, flip it over to side B.
So he's like, I can't release a 7-inch, but even though it sounds weird, I dig the music. So let's just release it as an EP. So we just did that. And
so did you have to do like a whole, we're signed to Tooth and Nail contract?
No, we weren't even really signed with them. It was just... it was just a thing where I think he gave us like 500 CDs or something and said, that's your payment for, you know, doing this. And
that's a cool payment.
There's no obligation, you know, you don't have to keep recording. And we had no, it could have been that we wanted to make a second record and he didn't want to, you know, there was no obligation on either side.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, it's got like the best contract that any band ever got.
Yeah.
Most people complain about their
right, contracts. Right.
They're locked in. They can't do anything ever again.
He told us later. He told us it was like the best-selling EP on Tooth and Nail that they ever had, or something. And so, yeah, there was a buzz about it. So that's why he wanted to go ahead and do a real contract.
So then he did Foehammer. By that point, he was like, "All right, well, we're gonna do an album." How did that work?
It kind of sucked because we went on a tour around the U.S. and
Training for Utopia, right?
Yeah, he wanted a record really quick, and we just didn't have the material. And you know, we were out on the road. It's hard to, you know, write new songs when you're not practicing.
Right.
Yeah.
So we got back, and we only had my memory of this is we only had like. A couple months to record, you know, to put together a whole album's worth of material, and we only had like, I think maybe 2 extra songs other than the EP, and we couldn't just record the EP again. Foehammer to me is a lot just kind of jams, almost like unrealized, unfleshed out ideas, and the lyrics were all just sort of thrown together, and you know, and then the fiasco of actually recording the thing, just all that together, just made it. You had the potential of what was it? Well, the fiasco was we had, if I remember right, we had like 2 weeks or 10 days booked in this nice studio, and since the first record didn't turn out that well with Tim Mack, we found out later basically that he was losing his hearing, and that's why it didn't turn out well or something, and we thought, oh gosh, well let's just get Steve Austin, because Steve Austin has credits on the Willpower record, you know. So we thought, well, that'll be just as good. And so it was in the early winter or late fall or something like that, and Steve Austin is in Boston, and they were snowed in for all these days, and so we had the studio time booked, but we had no producer. So, we had to record. We did the same thing. We recorded like 70 minutes of material instead of a reasonable like 45. And we only had maybe, I don't know, if I remember right, maybe 2 days to track and 2 days to mix. You know, that's just not enough time to put out a professional sounding record.
Yeah,
and he, Steve Austin, if you guys know Today is the Day, which I'm sure you do, by the time he went from Willpower to the next record, his whole aesthetic completely changed. You know, he went from the huge, roomy, you know, kind of sound to real tight and real scooped, you know, bassy and trebly, but no mid-range, and the drums are super tight, you know, and...
Well, that's when he started to record his own music, was the...
Yes, exactly. Well, he did record Willpower, but it was just in another studio. His stuff just had I think he played into the strengths of digital. It's like, well, if it has to be digital, I might as well make it work. And so he had that whole aesthetic, and he tried to make, you know, me sound like that, and Ricky sound like that, and he mixed it all weird and scooped and... I don't know. It was a very frustrating thing.
Yeah!
Yeah, there's got it. It's got its sonic problems, but I really enjoy Rock the Foe Hammer.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad to hear it.
I got a sneak preview of it when it we went to Cornerstone 98 or 99, I can't remember what year. Whatever year it wasn't out yet, but it was recorded. and we connected with Ricky there, and he was like, you guys want to hear the full length? And he played it for us in his you remember that camper he was staying with Anna. And and he played us the album, and I remember we were thinking, like, this is totally not what I expected it to sound like.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I just remember the sonic, the music styles changed a lot. It was a lot more, we've talked about this before, you describe it more like a playful Cherubs, Melvins kind of an influence, as opposed to a Neurosis, dark, brooding.
Well, not, yeah. If it was Melvins, you know, Cherubs, all that, I would have loved it, but it didn't even kind of turn out like that even. Yeah. Like, a good way to think about it is the way that In Vain We Fail, the end of that song,
yeah,
versus the Ketechumen version of that riff. It just, even though it's the same exact riff, same exact tempo, everything, it sounds completely different because of the way it was done. And right. Steve just kind of turned the production of that into this thing that we weren't at all, you know? If you heard us live, we didn't sound anything like that record.
Well, I did catch you live. I did, once again, I did happen to show up at the Cornerstone at the right year.
Yeah. What do you think, the way that we come across live?
Well, it's a lot heavier.
Yeah.
A lot louder. I saw you as a three-piece. But I saw you in between records, so you guys were still playing the EP stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if there was anything else in there or not. I can't remember. But Rock the Foe Hammer hadn't come out yet, but you were that lineup.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, the show was great. Slade, John Ford came out and did the vocals he did on The Quest. He came out and
yeah.
did
that.
But, and you guys
I
had
would
the,
say we had a thick sound would be a good way to put it.
Yeah, yeah.
Live. That's just how we sounded, was thick. And meaty, yeah. And the way that Foe Hammer record turned out was tinny and abrasive and just kind of, I don't know, it just didn't represent us at all, really.
Yeah. Oh, you guys were definitely more of a live band. I mean, just from the one time I saw you.
I agree.
And the footage.
Even the EP, I mean, even though the EP sounds a little bit better, it still didn't really, like, yeah. I don't know. A lot of people said that. They were like, well, you know, at least people can see you live, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and speaking of that, you guys put the record out. I think about the time Rock the Foe Hammer came out, you guys were pretty much done, right?
Yeah, I don't remember when it came out. We recorded it in '99 sometime, and everybody was just in a real period of change then. You know, like I think Ricky was just having his second kid or going to, and Phil was wanting to move to Georgia to play with World Against World, and he met a girl that he ended up marrying, and I had, you know, met my future wife, and we were spending a bunch of time together, and it was just depressing, you know, and...
Wasn't Jesus People USA somewhere involved in that, or...
After we broke up, they went ahead, Ricky and Anna moved there, but,
okay.
You know, it seemed like a lot of it was, sort of a disillusionment with the record label and the way that the record turned out, and we were like, "Cal, you know, all this energy and all this passion, and then that happens, and then the label's kind of fighting you too, and
yeah.
It just took all the steam out of us, you know." And we're like, "Well, we have these, you know, like I wanted to get married, and Phil wanted to get married, and it just seemed like it was like, yeah, we're done with this, you know."
Yeah, that's pretty much the spirit of this podcast. It's like married guys who at one time said, "I'm done with this. I'm done.
Yeah.
Family time." And now we're like, I still want to do it a little bit. You know,
right.
Do it in different ways, figure out new ways to do it and talk about it and all that.
Yeah.
So then what happened to you? You got married and...
Yeah, so I moved to Oklahoma to go to school. So I did that for a couple years. And then did the music thing, and then when I got married in 99, I was like, well, now what am I going to do with my life, you know? I can't tour, like, you know, that's not really family conducive, and
right.
So, but I wanted to do something with music, so I just went to a local school here and studied music, and then I opened a studio and recorded and produced and mixed and all that for 5 years or so.
You're like, I'm not letting this bad production thing happen to me again.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I want to learn how to make this not happen.
Yeah.
I can relate with that.
Yeah. I had gotten into recording back in the 80s a little bit.
Oh, wow.
I had a friend who had a really nice studio, and I was really involved in a church that I was, you know, doing the music. I did drums and I did synthesizer, and I'd write songs and record my songs there. And I was also a jazz drummer in high school. And then, you know, I kind of always liked the recording side of things and writing songs. And so the idea was to open my own studio and kind of have it as, well, this can be my income, and then when I don't have bands, I'll write and produce my own stuff. But, you know, doesn't ever work out that way.
Sure, yeah. It's
always doing other people's stuff.
And you, did you get, I'm trying to remember the name of this, your record label that you did.
Raise the Sails.
Thank you. Raise the Sails. So when did that all come into play?
Towards the end of the time there. I had recorded a band, or actually I hadn't recorded them yet. I'd seen a band called Believing in June, and I thought they really had potential to, you know, kind of cross over and, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of possible market there. And so I said, well,
I'll tell you what, why don't I just go ahead and pay for this? We'll go, you know, we'll make that. We spent like $10,000 on that record.
And but as soon as that, well, not as soon as, pretty soon after that is when I started getting sick, and I just really wasn't able to market the record or do much with it. So yeah, I have all these Believing in June CDs laying around, still trying to recoup that $10,000.
Oh, man. Gotta put them up for sale.
But, yeah, exactly.
So you. This is around 2000, 2001, you started getting unhealthy? And
no, 2005, 2006.
Oh, it's that late in, okay.
Yeah, because I was fine for like 5 years. I was just doing the studio thing. And 2006, I think, is right about when I just couldn't work anymore. I tried to fight through it and, you know, force my mind and my body to cooperate, and it just wouldn't, you know.
Just kind of curious, like, what were the warning signs, like, in the beginning? And
when, yeah, at first I just felt like I had a flu all the time. And I just couldn't kick it, you know? And so I went to a doctor, went to another doctor. And, you know, flu's not that bad if you have it for, you know, 3, 4, 5 days. But
sure, right.
If you have that for 2 or 3 months in a row, it's like,
oh,
you
my God,
can hardly function, you know?
Right.
And, yeah, at first, you know, the doctor diagnosed me with depression and said that's why you can't think, you know, right, and you can't, you know, you're having all these brain farts and whatever it is in your brain that makes you able to accomplish things, you know. There's some part of your brain that's responsible for that, and it seems like I just hit a brick wall every time I go to stand up to do something, you know, and I just can't figure it out. I don't know what's going on, but
Can I ask? Was it a gradual thing, or did you like go to bed Monday fine and wake up Tuesday?
I think it was sudden in a relative sense. It wasn't in one day, but it was over a period of a few months. I think I just kind of went from I was fine to I couldn't get out of bed and didn't know why. So
wow, man,
makes you wonder if it was like all those years of playing drums and then like you stopped playing drums. Or weren't playing them as nearly as often, maybe, if some of that even contributed.
Well, that wouldn't be responsible for how I feel. I mean, I could see how that would affect somebody, but that would be
different from what's happening to me.
Yeah, Stephen, when you play drums in a metal band all the time and then suddenly you stop because of life, you get fat. I have that problem.
Yeah. I could see how that would like make somebody like feel blue or something, you know, like, oh gosh, I want to play music, but I just can't. I just don't feel good about it, and I'm kind of depressed. You know, it's not like that at all. It's like I'm crippled, you know.
Man. Wow. What is it?
Well, I've had about 15 diagnoses. There's a list of things that I've been diagnosed with, and I've noticed researching this that there's a lot of people that have these same things, and it's just hard to find. I think we're just at a point in history where it's sort of a newer thing, and 50 years from now, they'll look back and say, oh, that's whatever's disease, and now we know how to fix it, you know, but right now, it's like people don't, you know, like I've been diagnosed with fibromyalgia, you know, for example, and that covers, you know, that explains a lot of the pain that I have, and some of the fog, but it's kind of, it's deeper than just that. It's just, you know, fatigue. I can, you know, barely get out of bed. And
Well, the reason why I mentioned the drum thing was because I have chronic pain in my arms and stuff like that, and I have problems with my shoulders, and it's because I've done a lot of repeat movement.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So do you account for the pain?
Yeah, and like, you know, I was talking to Travis recently, totally a sidebar. We were talking about something similar. And
yeah.
I think it was you, Travis. Weren't you telling me about a friend of your mom's had a barbershop, and she just, like, she had done repeat movement all those years, and then she...
Yeah, I guess the way that my mom explained it to me, which is always talk about having to take something with a grain of salt, she gets a lot wrong in stories, but she had the same lady cutting her hair for a long time, and I guess Anne kind of, you know how hairdressers kind of stoop a little? They always have that little crink in their back because they're always kind of hunched a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, she did that for decades, you know, and then she decided she's going to shut the salon down for like 2 weeks. It was in the basement of her home, and her husband were going to completely remodel it, and she got down on her hands and knees and hand-scraped all the vinyl flooring up, like literally wham, 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 wham with a butter knife for hours and hours and hours on end, and practically overnight, like Monday into Tuesday or something like that, within a couple days, she just felt like, I feel terrible. Well, you just assume, well, I'm an older lady, I'm in my upper 40s or whatever, I overdid it. I hurt myself, I did too much. Just like if we just decided, hey, let's go on a 15-mile run, I wouldn't feel good the next day either, you know?
Yeah.
So she just chalked it up to, I did too much, and the pain never went away. And they diagnosed her with fibromyalgia, and within 3 months, the woman never even finished her floor. She had to shut the salon down because she had to have women come in and replace her to do the haircuts, and then all you're doing is paying them. So now she's like, I'm sustaining business, but I'm not making any money because all I'm doing is paying all the girls. And she closed up shop. And some all that to say, I'm looping around to my point. it was just something about they connected. Movement. Yeah, they were like, it's something about the way that you were kind of contorting your body incorrectly for years and years and years and years, and then the trauma of what you did with your floor, like, activated it,
for lack
of a better way to put it, and it never went away. And a poor lady, I mean, if she would have never shut down the salon and did her floor, would she just be a hairdresser with a back problem now? You know, like, I don't know what that means. But
the reason I brought it up wasn't
crazy
necessarily to say, Tim, this is your problem, and you.
No. I mean, what the hell do I know?
Yeah, no, right. I just reason I'm actually asking a question with that in mind, those examples in mind. Like, how much of that sort of therapy, like the whole like having to stretch differently and do things differently to break sort of the, I don't know, like to me, sounds like chronic pain's connected to a lot of like stretches and exercises that you don't ever do.
Yeah.
Because of your, you know, your job, you're always repeating the same movements every day. Has any of that come into it at all? Or,
well, yeah, it's interesting you say that. There's a mainstream, you know, it's typical American doctors how they look at fibro, and they don't think like that. But I'm from Portland, like I said, but we moved here to this tiny town in Utah because of a doctor who has been having some success with treating fibro, which is supposedly incurable. And his take is that he thinks there's a mechanical cause to it, like you're talking about. And he treats it by doing a bunch of mechanical changes. And so, you know, I'm sort of, I'm putting all my eggs in that basket, kind of. Like, I'm hoping that
you might as well
changing these mechanical things could, you know, he's convinced that it will change your entire nervous system to get your, you know, to get your spine right, to get your nerves not being clumped together. Most people with fibro have a clump in the back of their neck that is just like a solid clump, and they say that the communication between your nervous system and your brain gets stopped there, and so your brain is receiving, you know, feedback pain from your body, and your body says there's no pain, which there isn't. Then it goes up through your body and it hits that spot in your brain, and it's just complete chaos, electric amplification. Your brain receives a signal saying, oh my God, you're in so much pain. And so you feel physical pain, you know, because that's, you know, your brain shoves that back down to you and says, okay, your legs hurt, your feet hurt, your arms hurt, your back hurts, you know.
So your brain is telling you you feel pain, but medically,
there's no cause.
Medically, there's no reason to have pain.
Exactly, yeah.
That is effed up, man.
Yeah. It's much more of a brain disease, I think, than most people realize. Yeah. I predict that in the future that'll be common knowledge. Because there's so many other mental parts of this that are, you know, contributing to all of this. It's just like, I don't know, I feel like I have about 20% of my brain functioning right now, you know, and just can't live like that, you know?
Yeah.
Because you're too busy throwing around pain. Like, I mean... Like, for those of us that don't have a problem like that, when I'm in pain, when I get the flu, I'm only operating at a certain percentage, too, because all I can focus on is, ugh, this hurts so much, the pain. So, yeah, and then just the fatigue of dealing with it, like you said, you get a flu, it kicks the hell out of you for 72 hours, and then you get up, and you drink your Gatorade, and you go back to work. I mean, you get over it, you know what I mean? The fatigue of dealing with it for as long as you have is just kicking the snot out of you. Yeah, that's tough.
Right. Well, it's confusing, too, because, like, for example, I have a diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome, and then I have another diagnosis having to do with my brain, my, you know, mental side of things, but it's like, how many of these things are all just the same thing? You know, like, the way you described it is, if you're in pain for a long time, it affects your brain because your brain just gets tired, you know? And then you get fatigue because you can't handle the pain anymore. But there's all these separate diagnoses that all might be, you know, it all might be the same problem. Who knows, you know? And
it's like, what came first, the chicken or the egg, you know? Like,
yeah. There's those 15 things that are all diagnoses, and I'm just thinking maybe it's all the same stuff, you know? And
the clump and the stoppage of the right signals is causing the fatigue of the body, which is causing maybe actual pain. Now
it's confusing. I've had a lot of doctors tell me a lot of different things, and nobody has a perfect handle on it.
So where are you at with the treatments? Like, are you getting improvements? Are you able to move around more? What's going on there?
Yeah, I kind of was for a while, but man, it's it's just really hard to explain. The mental part of it is such a major component to it. It's very easy to get overwhelmed and bogged down mentally.
Yeah.
And the program that I'm doing is a very physical program. I mean, I have to reshape my spine and rebuild my back muscles and my neck and everything. And, you know, it's not like I take a pill. You know, it's really physical.
Right.
But when you have
fatigue and
pain, it's very difficult to do the physical things. Mm-hmm. So, I'm doing really bad right now with that.
Man.
I'm sorry to hear that, man.
I have another doctor that's about 45 minutes away who has a completely different approach. He thinks that fibromyalgia is like a similar to like a bacterial and viral thing, and he says that he's been curing people by doing this whole other method of killing this really specific virus that he says that everybody that he's dealt with that has fibro has this thing. So supposedly if I go to him for like 30 treatments, then he says that I'll be better, you know, but you know, still, even if that does help with like the pain, I can't even stand for more than an hour in a day because my spine collapses on itself because I don't have any back muscles. So I mean, how would you know, killing a virus take care of that, you know? So I think it's going to require more of a multi-tiered approach.
Okay.
And it's so discouraging because, you know, I can only imagine, like, when they, you know, they say 30 treatments for this new thing, and you're already about 8,000 treatments in from all the other things. You know, like, this past week I had a sleep study for sleep apnea. Well, I knew I had sleep apnea before I got into all this, but I thought it would be as simple as, look, I'm going to go to the doctor, and I'm going to tell them, look, I'm snoring, I got the sleep apnea stuff going on, like, I know I stopped breathing in my sleep, can you... Give me the cure.
Yeah.
And you know, and they're like, okay, well, we're going to send you to this place, we're going to send you to that place. And of course, All these things are spread out a month apart, and by the time you get done getting your treatment for the one thing you went for, it's like the money that goes into it, the time that goes into it.
Yeah.
It's such a long drag. And I'm thinking with stuff like this, what you're going through, it's like 30 treatments, man. That doesn't sound like a lot, but
it sounds like nothing compared to the whole big picture, though.
The whole process.
That sounds really easy to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I can't imagine, like, it must be really discouraging to move your family to one place,
get
a bunch of treatments. It's kind of, maybe working a little bit, but not enough.
Yeah.
And someone over there says, okay, come over here and do this with me. You know,
it's
just... And the time between it takes and all that.
So, well, and the whole time life is going on. You know, my kids have gone from
3
years old to almost 12, you know, and my wife is, you know, waiting for life to start, kind of, you know. And it's like life doesn't just pause for you, you know.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, let me take a time out while I fix these problems. It's
right,
like, wow.
Right.
Dude, I'm getting older. My wife's getting older. My kids are getting older.
So your kids they understand what's going on, I imagine, and
they're great about it. But you know, when you become a parent, you have all these, you know, dreams of the great father you're going to be, you know, and I'm going to do all these things, and I'm in bed 23 hours a day, so you know,
brother, I'm not in any way, shape, or form trying to compare stories at all, but I have a bad shoulder. My shoulder just took a turn for the worse over the past couple of years. I can't. Sorry. I mean, dude, I used to coach Little League. I threw 300 fastballs a night to a Little League team, and I can't throw a ball to my son anymore. You know, and
your problems aren't any less real than mine. I mean,
sure. I mean,
that's just as devastating to you. You know,
it is. I mean, I definitely can't fathom what it's like to not be able to stand for more than an hour without pain. But you know, when it comes time to, like, you know, hey, go long, and you chuck a spiral, and instantly one throw is like, holy shit, that hurt. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, that's, dude, I'm 39. You know, like Louis C.K. says, that just hurts now. That doesn't get fixed anymore. That just hurts all the time now. That's just
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Well, thank you, but I can't fathom what it would have been like. I have 12-year-old twins, and
interesting. Mine are twins too.
Get out of here. And a 7-year-old.
Oh man, yeah, I totally. I don't know if I even knew that. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, I have boy, girl, 12-year-old twins, and a 7-year-old son. and I can't fathom what it would have been like since they were, like you said, since they were two. I don't know what it would have been like to have been like, hey.
They don't even know me healthy, you know. I've had 36 years of health and just the last 10 years of not health, but they've only been in my life the last, you know,
sure,
a little bit. So it's like, I was a real person before this, I promise, you know.
Yeah. Oh man, that's a
I did stuff, you know.
That's discouraged. Wasn't always bedbound,
whatever. So, anyway, well, one thing it does though in a really profound way, it really makes you sensitive and sympathetic to other people's pain, you know, and not just physical pain, but the things that they go through. You know, I thought that I was, you know, kind of a nice guy, and, you know, and, oh, you know, I'm sorry that you're going through that, but it really makes it in a real deep kind of way that you just, you really feel for people, you know.
Well, look at you finding the silver lining. That's
well, I didn't go looking for it. It was just sort of a...
Nah, dude, I feel it was a result. That's humbling to hear your story and then say it really helped me be able to relate with other people's pain.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. St. Timothy.
No, dude, oh, gosh. You know, not even close, dude.
A lot of people tend to go the opposite direction than that, though. They'll see their own pain and their own struggle as a sort of, you know, I had to man up. I have to deal with it. Why don't you deal with your problems, too?
Yeah.
It tends to be the attitude for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So it is interesting that you were.
Or it would be easy, and I could even see. I think what I know about my personality, I could see me having to fight this. If the roles were reversed, there would be a part of me that might think, "Yeah, I wish my shoulder was my only problem, Dick." You know. Like, you don't want to be that guy either.
Yeah. Logically, I could see how you would think that, but for some reason, it's just not like that. It's just
you got some compassion, man. That's Yeah, that's oof, man. So this is a good segue into I know that Steven has been tinkering away at trying to do something about it, and the only thing that us dumb musicians know how to do is push music around on people.
Well, I was gonna say, you know, to the listeners at home, some of what we're saying here, we're saying for the sake of to broadcast it to you, but I knew of. You know, Tim's health and talking to Ricky from Warlord back a couple years ago. I can't remember what year it was now, 2010 maybe, 9, 10, 11, somewhere in there. And he, you know, I said, so, you know, I was talking to Ricky more than Tim then. And in fact, I hadn't talked to Tim since I met him in Cornerstone. And so, but I was like really curious, like, oh, hey, how the Warlord guys doing? And, you know, I miss you guys. You guys were great. You know, how's Tim doing? And he said, yeah, Tim's been really sick. This has been going on. And he's been trying to get, you know, here's this website. He's been trying to raise some money to get some treatments and stuff. And I don't know what caused me to do this, but I remember just looking you up and saying, hey, dude, fan of your band, your story really touched me, and I'd like to see if there's any sort of way we can like do like a benefit CD to help raise some money for some funds. And we got to talking through that. We got to become pretty good friends, even though we don't hang out because we're so far away from each other. And
Utah will do that to an East Coast guy.
The whole grand scheme idea was to like try to get a new Warlord track and then try to get some other bands, and just fast forward because things, you know, the project sort of kept coming up and then kept getting buried by problems and things not working out. But long story short, we managed to get all the things we wanted to get. And I mean, Tim will be able to tell you a little bit more about the Warlord track, but in the beginning, it was kind of like more of a Ricky Rogers as Warlord track, and it really ended up becoming a real Warlord track, a track where
it actually is now.
Tim actually got to do the drums on it, and
awesome.
And Phil, you know, far away in another part of the world doing his family thing, went in the studio and recorded some bass and back vocals, and we sort of just got these tracks together. I am in no way trying to be like a hero here and, you know, oh, I came in and decided to, you know, I just, you know, my whole thinking was I really just wanted to do something. I mean, I realized that a compilation CD is not going to, you know, save, you know, a giant debt of medical expenses and stuff. But to me, I just really wanted to do something that would just be more of an encouragement and maybe just help out a little or however much it could. So I don't really see myself as that important in the grand scheme, but more just presented this as an idea, just a way to encourage a friend and go, you know, here's a little extra cash, you know.
Yeah, well, so, that's exactly what it's done so far, even though it's not even out yet. It's definitely, it's just knowing that somebody would go to that length, you know, it's really cool.
It's definitely appreciated.
It's been a lot of fun to watch it progress too, and especially the Warlord track, and just how that all came
together. Yeah, how it's definitely progressing. It's due to be mixed this weekend, and hopefully it'll rock. It's gone from Ricky tapping out computer drums on his keyboard and, you know, playing all the parts and everything to Phil's bass track got tracked in a different studio, and Phil did background vocals, and I can't actually play the drums. I can barely hold a drumstick now, but I have some software that I figured out how to coax real sounds out of it by clicking on my mouse and add it all together, and it actually sounds like a real Warlord song now. So
And you know, thinking about that, thinking about the process and how you guys got it together and all, I am so thankful that it really is your performance in terms of your what you would have done, what kind of a beat you would have played, and your ideas. Cool. And you know, in today's day and age, the way people record drums, they're about halfway what you're doing anyway. They may have played it, but then they end up replacing it anyway.
You know what? I was just thinking about that. It's not a real recording. It's not the raw actual drum set. It's not the real drummer. Blah 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 blah. But the only difference between that situation where someone is cheating and this situation, the only thing is just perspective. Just listen to the story and understand what the man did. He crawled his way in here and did what he could. You then appreciate that level of technology rather than some dude phoning it in. And I want Meshuggah's kick drum, and I want Lamb of God's snare drum, and I'm just going to go shopping and go pick what I want and everything.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Build that together and make me sound better than I am, you know?
Yeah.
So, it's really cool.
And that's what this podcast episode is really for, is like, understand what you're hearing. Don't just listen to a track for 10 seconds and go, this band sucks, click next. Like, understand what goes on behind some of these things.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can honestly say right now, in addition to a lot of past bands that have got some notoriety, new bands that are really exciting, up and coming, we've got a pretty lengthy list of bands. A lot of them are bands people have heard of and love, and kind of in the spirit of the old Tooth and Nail comps. That was kind of what we aimed to do.
Yeah, I'm kind of impressed with what you're pulling together here, I got to be honest.
But in addition to all those bands, and you know, me and Tim, we can talk a little bit more about that. But we have an honest to goodness new Warlord song with the Rock the Foe lineup.
Well, and there's also just because nobody knows yet, but there was a song that was recorded for Rock the Foe Hammer that never got put on the record. And I don't know how I got these, but I have the multi tracks to Rock the Foe Hammer, and so I dumped them in the computer.
That's so rad.
And one problem with, you know, Rock the Foe Hammer was the way the drums were recorded, for one. And so I was able to just keep Ricky's guitar and vocal and Phil's bass, and I just changed. I pretty much kept what I played, but I changed all the drum sounds out to sound like how we really wanted them to sound back in the 90s, you know. And so there's actually two songs that people wouldn't have heard before on this comp. And in my mind, they sound a lot more like what we envisioned in the first place, you know.
Yeah, man, I'm so excited, man. It's coming together finally, and we secured a release with Veritas Vinyl. Thank you, Jesse. He's going to put a small run of CDs out, and we're going to see how it goes. And all proceeds are going to go to Tim. We're going to
set up to my doctor now. Anyway.
His doctor's mansion. We're gonna make it nice, and we're gonna replace a couple windows in the mansion.
Yeah. You mean our 2-bedroom apartment?
So, do you want to talk a little bit about the comp at all? You want to plug it a little bit in terms of?
Yeah,
the artists?
I'm not sure what to say. I mean, the main thing I want to say is that I've just been, honestly, I've just been really surprised that anybody cares. You know, I mean. You've asked, you know, most of the bands, and as you've mentioned people, it kind of has made me think of a few people, and I've said, hey, you know, there's this comp going on, and I haven't had anybody, you know, say no. Everybody's just been so cool about turning something in and just wanting to be a part of it, and
I don't get it. I mean, it's
a lot really of people cool, from, you know? A lot of people from the music industry on both sides are just like, oh, Tim from Warlord? Yeah, 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 I'm in. Guys that don't even know you. Guys are just like fans of your band, you know? And
yeah, it's been weird.
A lot of these newer bands that are just like, oh, yeah, Warlord was one of my favorite bands. Like, here's a song from our band. You know, guys like Slaves BC and Maranatha, you know, these newer up-and-coming bands, like, are excited because they're just, you know, they're touched by the story, and then they're like, okay, yeah, yeah, I'd love to be a part of this project. And, it, you know, it doesn't hurt them to have promotion either. So, you know, to them, it's a win-win on both sides.
I hope so, yeah.
Oh, definitely. And you know, a lot of the dudes from the past, you know, like Living Sacrifice and who else we got?
I can't believe you got that.
Yeah, I'm probably most excited unreleased... about that than any other song. No one's heard that, and
yeah,
it was from the hammering process, and something happened where the hard drive got jumbled or something, and they were really excited about it, and it just got lost. So when Steven talked to Bruce about it, Bruce was way on board, and I mean that. And the other cool thing is Brandon was so cool about it. I mean, if I was Brandon, I'd think of that as an asset, you know, like. Living Sacrifice wasn't making a record every year, you know, and
right
to be able to that's have true, that gem from the past, he was like, "Yeah, you can use it."
Brandon, we had to get permission, but Brandon was like, "Yeah, do it." In fact, Brandon, you know, he could have even technically kind of been a jerk about the Warlord material, but he was, with the exception.
Yeah, he owns those songs, so he said, "Go ahead and use that one from Foehammer," and he's been great about it.
Good point. I didn't think of that.
And as a thank you to Brandon, we decided to rip off his ideas and make this comp sort of like a Tooth and Nail comp.
Yeah, just as a thank you.
That's exactly what it is. It's a thank you. That was the whole time. So what are we calling this compilation?
Well, the working title is We Bear the Scars. Somebody came up with it. That we just put it out there on the internet and said, whoever comes up with the best title gets a CD.
I wish we had that thread in front of us, man. We had so many good joke titles.
I just liked it because, you know, not only We Bear the Scars as far as me, you know, like bearing the scars of life, but a lot of the bands, you know, that are my age and those guys, a lot of these guys have been through a lot, you know. I mean, there's other people that aren't healthy either, and even if they are healthy, they've just been through stuff, and it's kind of like we all together have borne the scars, but here's something positive from it all, you know?
Well, as far as my involvement, I would put the stamp on it and say, absolutely, that's the best title we can come up with. We've tried to come up with other ones, and they've been mostly just humorous. We've, you know, me going like, well, you know, we're in the spirit of helpless amongst friends. Why don't we just call it, like, Help Amongst Friends?
Yeah.
And everybody's just like, ugh.
My submission for Warlord Schmorlord was immediately taken off the table. I'm upset about it. I'd like to put it back in.
So yeah, we're closer than we've ever been. We're right at the cusp.
Yep, Beautiful. I'm excited, man. And hopefully something positive will come from it.
I'm sure something, but even if we only sell 10 units, you know, that's still helpful and good. And
yeah, you know, we still get the high five and go, new Warlord song, excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it'll be out, you know, it's not like it'll go out of print, so, you know, even 2 years from now, if someone wants to buy one, it'll still
And of course, there'll be something. A digital copy as well.
Yep.
So, man. Well, it was awesome having you on tonight, man.
Seriously, what a great conversation. Yeah, I loved it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it myself, too.
I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot of things I didn't know about you, man. And your crazy fly-in appointments from record labels. And
I think there was only one of those.
Fair enough, but it's one more than I've ever had.
Yeah, right, exactly. let me add up all mine. You're still winning.
That's funny.
The one more time, the band in between Mr. Bishop's Fist and Warlord, pronounce it again for me.
Well, the real name is Catechumen, but we called it Catechumen.
Catechumen. I literally never heard that before. I had no idea it existed. I didn't know it was happening, and I'm super stoked to know that. I mean,
yeah,
that's just cool. I like these kinds of stories. That's the whole point of this thing.
We have tons of practice tapes, and a future project, probably way in the future, will be to sort through those and just probably just give it away or something, because
right on.
The demand is so low.
I want to release a cassette or a CD if we get enough material of that
stuff. Oh yeah, we got lots of stuff if I remember right. At least enough for a CD.
I think we should release it exclusively on ADAT video.
You got it.
Cartridges. Yeah. Just so they can say, oh, we finally got it. Oh, just to further piss people
off. Crap. Now I got to get on eBay and buy like an $800 ADAT player.
Nice.
There you go. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. And people always say thoughts and prayers. We're definitely going to keep you and your family lifted up in prayer. You're going through some stuff. And anything that we can do with the podcast and the hope for the compilation helps. And definitely want to stay in touch with you. You sound like you know what you're doing when it comes to recording drums, and I don't. So you can educate vicariously through me and show me what I'm doing wrong.
Yeah, it'd be my pleasure, man. Thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks so much for your time, man. God bless you.
I'm praying for you as well, buddy. Thanks for being on.
Definitely.
Thank you so much.
Good night, buddy. Thanks.
Good night to you.
Love you. Take care. Bye-bye.